And you're on the first of the show tonight with Ben Vidgen. I'm going to talk to you about a few little things that have been going on around New Zealand at the moment. But, you know, as a way of introduction, just let me explain a wee bit about who I am and what I do. Obviously, my name is Ben Vidgen. Down in Dunedin, which is where I live, I run a little newspaper called The Post and Gazette, which we put around the cafes going from Oamaru to Invercargill. We do that every 2 months, and it pretty much just covers, you know, pretty light, fluffy bunny stuff, but we always try to flick in at least one good story there each month, which is on an investigative journalism background, which is pretty much where I kind of got my start in the media. I started out in the wonderful world of media back in, about 1994, when I first started working for a newspaper down in Queenstown called The Mountain Scene, aka The Mountain Scream. And I wrote a little column there called the Ben C. Vidgen Q Files, and we talked about human interest stuff and a little bit of politics. And then I went off and I worked for Alan Jones in the wonderful world of corporate media and discovered that I absolutely hated it. I had never seen so much lies and bollocks in all my life. At the time I went to live in Sydney. It was the beginning of the election between Paul Keaton and John Howard. Alan Jones, former speechwriter for Malcolm Fraser, the former Prime Minister of Australia, was the man that Alan's kind of signed up with, and as a consequence, only John Howard was allowed on the show. This is one of Sydney's biggest talkback radio stations, and here you had election year, and only one guy was allowed his piece of the cake, and I found within about 2 months that I wasn't cut out for corporate media. So I went off and I did what any sane person does, ran away from corporate media. Spent a lot of time in Australia, had a lot of time, and I came back to New Zealand, and then this was circa 1996, and I just had the Winebox Inquiry, and talking all about things like tax evasion and money laundering, and people like Bay Richwhite, and a long number of names which we're quite familiar with now with the whole dirty politics saga. And I also discovered that when I came back, having picked up a book called Paradise Conspiracy, that I knew a few things that weren't being covered, and I put a little synopsis together and sent off to Howling the Moon, and next thing you know, I got a book published in 1999 called State Secrets. 15,000 copies produced, bestsellers list for, will take 3 or 4 months, not one single newspaper review in the entire country. Now, at the time when I came out, there were a couple of things that were being said that, for example, New Zealand did not have organised crime. I was being told by colleagues in the media that, oh no, there's no such thing as organised crime in New Zealand. It's disorganised crime. There was no such thing as arms running. There was no such thing as white-collar crime. And I ignored all this, and I put this into my book, and I was told by people this was all a conspiracy theory. Except for, if you pick up the book today, State Secrets, and you read it, and you look what I said then, and you look at the country that we live in now, and what even our good old-fashioned mainstream media, who aren't necessarily the sharpest razor blades in the pack, will tell you, it's pretty much all fairly mainstream stuff that I was talking about 10 years ago. And that's pretty much will be my pattern all my life. I've spoken stories, not necessarily because I'm the smartest guy in the room, but predominantly because I do one thing. I actually go and do a little bit of research off Google. I go to archives. I roll up my sleeves. I go talk to first-person sources. And I write my stories not based upon my assumptions or the things that will make me, you know, you cover stories that, oh God, I'm going to cover a story, I'm going to sound like a complete dickhead. Well, I do that anyway. And hindsight's been a pretty good fan of mine. It's shown the years, pretty much shown that most of what I've reported on has had some, well, not some, a lot of basis in truth. And it's interesting because these days what I find is that off the track, a lot of these mainstream people come to me and they talk to me or they follow what I'm doing on Facebook. But, you know, I have quite a few well-known journalists follow what I do on Facebook. But they don't give me any kind of acknowledgement. They just pick up the main parts of what you're saying and they do the story kind of very deluded, which is, you know, you got to take things as you can. And I kind of guess I resign myself these days to like realizing that I'm never going to get given a Qantas award or a Coca-Cola award for journalism or whatever corporation that pays it. I just don't get invited to those kind of parties. But I do put stories out there which other people out there follow, and I do put footballs on the playing field. And that's pretty much what it is. What I do with State Secrets, and after State Secrets, I've, you know, got best-selling status. I thought, man, this is fantastic. You know, it's great. You know, I'm in the wonderful world of media now, and doors are going to open. And then they didn't. And I spent a couple of years away from it, all working in the shadows part-time, till eventually I moved down to Dunedin, and I started my own little publication, which has been called Deadline. We've since then changed the name to the Postman Gazette. I've been running for 11 years now. And we've broken scoop after scoop after scoop. And, you know, for example, Edward Snowden talked about a base being there, being based up in Northland. Well, last year when I spoke at the anti-GCSB rally, this is exactly what I talked about. And this was, you know, 6 months beforehand. And I did that. And I also turned around and spoke 3-4 years beforehand about the concept, about the fact that National Party likes to pay people to write embarrassing stories. I said this in 2007. I was rung up. I said, hey, you know me, I'm 2007, just give or take. I'm talking off the cuff, so be with me about it. I was rung up and said, hey, do you know any embarrassing stories about Helen Clark? Well, actually, I do. I know a lot of embarrassing stories about a lot of different MPs and a lot of people out there. But generally speaking, I'm not out to report people's personal lives. What people do in their personal life is their personal life. But out of curiosity, they said, yeah, sure I do. But, you know, who's paying the check? Oh, I can't tell you that. And that was the end of the conversation. But I knew the personal question has gone connections to the National Party. And along with other details, I published this. That was, give or take, 2007. Well, we now know, but thanks to Mickey Hager, and Mickey does fantastic work, that this is the kind of politics that we live in. So that's my basic background. I have a background in investigative journalism. I've written a couple of books. I run my own little newspaper. I have a website called www.postmanproductions. It won't actually be back up online until next month because we're just doing the maintenance on it. But amongst the fluffy bunnies, good art, good music, which is, you know, something I'm actually proud of. I do believe that you need to have... the soul needs to be fed, not just the brain. But amongst all that fluffy bunny stuff, I always try to regularly put up good, strong stories. And I like to think I've got a good track record of seeing a little bit beyond the headlines, and largely because I'm all up my sleeves and I get down there and I find the primary source material. So that's my background. However, you know, what we're talking about tonight is we're going to cover a few different bits and pieces, and it's going to be a very eclectic show. Normally what's going to happen when you listen to the show is that what I'll actually do is I'll have a format. It will be an hour long, and amongst that show I'll break it up with two or three songs from independent musicians. And I said, you know, I think you've got to feed the soul as well as the brain. But tonight we're going to cover a whole bunch of different areas and bounce from here to there. At the moment, we have the situation of the election. Well, crystal ball time. How do I think the election's going to roll out? Well, I think it's going to go two ways. Well, actually, it's going to go three ways. The worst case scenario is that basically, when I say worst case scenario, not from a partisan viewpoint, but because of the outside influences controlling it, but I think what we're going to end up having is a National Party with Winston Peters crossing the floor. And you have Deputy Prime Minister Winston Peters, the National Party, and Colin Craig, fundamentalist Christian, well, not as much fundamentalist Christian, I have no problem with Christianity or any religion, but fundamentalist organized religion. And we're going to go back, kind of like, we're going to be a little bit like about as Republican as you can be. That's one scenario. The second scenario that will happen is that, and I think this is actually probably the most likely of all, is that come the election night, what will actually happen is that there will be enough votes so that John Key isn't the Prime Minister, lesser of Weevils, yay! But what we will end up having is that we're going to end up with a Winston Peters New Zealand First Party. We're going to end up with the Māori votes, which when I did my recent write-up on the House, it was actually something I forgot about, the compulsory votes. The Māori Party that have actually happily crossed the floor and supported National and things, and the thing has done them a lot of damage, but they'll come in, and then we'll have the Labour Party. And we'll also as a result, the Green Party. But what will happen is that the Greens will be shut out, and the cabinet positions will go to Winston Peters, they'll go to the Māori Party, and they'll go to the National Party. And this is an issue of personal politics, but it's exceptional. I don't think this is what New Zealand wants either way. And, you know, whether you want to think about the Greens, and we'll get into that a wee bit as well, when you have one party that gets nearly 20 vote seats, you think if they're the second largest player on the field, that maybe they should get a couple of cabinet minister positions. But they probably won't if that's the coalition, because that'll be the deal. Winston Peters to say, well, I won't form a coalition unless Greens get from the outside. So we'll end up with this representation, which doesn't necessarily represent anybody, national, across the board, what they want. But it'll be probably the most next to the position I put on my first scenario on national, Colin and Winston, the most conservative viewpoint that we have. You could say, if you want, the Republican life. The best case scenario in terms of, and I'll explain this very shortly, the best case scenario is that we'll actually have a situation where we end up with a coalition that's made up of basically the Māori Party, the Greens, Labour, New Zealand First, and the Internet Māori Party. And I say this will be the best representation, because I think this will truly represent, across the board, what the greater majority of Kiwis want. And let's go back there for a second too, because you could say at the moment, oh no, John Key's got 64% representation. Well, that's not quite strictly speaking true. What he actually has is a representation of the people that voted. If you look across the board, that figure drops down quite remarkably. I think about 34% of New Zealand actually would support what he's doing. That's not a representation of overall what New Zealand wants. My scenario of the New Zealand Party, the Greens, the Internet Party, the Māori Party, that's closer to a larger representation. And again, that's not the perfect solution, but we'll come into that a little bit further down the road. The great thing about if we have the Internet Māori Party, and you don't necessarily have to agree with their policies, but what you do have is you have one party out of all the parties that I talked about that have an exception to the rule. And this is the fact that unlike National, Labour, or the Greens, you have a party that is not made up of politicians leading their party, i.e. the ones that sit on the front bench, that as a general rule had got to that path by going to university, an offshore university, normally Ivy League, Harvard, Yale, or Oxford, getting to those universities via a scholarship, which when you look at who funds those scholarships, roads, stadiums, etc., you're talking about a fairly vested group of people. They fund your scholarships to get there, and you get into these academic environments. And I have two degrees. I love academia. I love the whole concept of university. It's what I've been raised with. Unfortunately, we don't live in the old school academia of the world that I grew up in, the utopic version of it anyway. We grew up in a world which is not based on academic methodology, three sources, footnoting, letting the facts fall where they are, regardless of what your opinion are. We grew up in a policy where if you don't preach the party line, you don't get the marks. You don't get the scholarship. You don't get the doctorate. You don't get the tenure. You've got to preach the party line. Otherwise, you don't get up to the next stage. So ultimately, whether we're talking about people that are sort of the front benches of Labour, National, the Greens, we have people that are preaching party policy. They come back to New Zealand, they preach policy which is formed overseas, and this is not policy that represents New Zealand. This is policy that represents vested interests. This is policy which supports things like Agenda 21 or GPA, I think it's Global Parliamentarian for Action, or otherwise known as Parliamentarian for World Order, is what it used to originally called before they changed the name. So we end up with these people that are not representing local, national sovereign interests. They're representing offshore ideology that is generally funded by vested interest groups, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. And these are groups in turn that push their agendas through based on who's funding them. So whether it's Enron or Sir Robert Ogden, the biggest coal guy in the world, these are the people that finance the IMF, the World Bank. And if they don't push their agenda, these guys don't finance it. And if they don't finance it, then the whole thing comes to a crashing end. So back here in New Zealand, we have people supporting, and you'll find this in this case, National Labour and the Greens Party, supporting Agenda 21. This is a policy which talks about centralisation of the monetary system, centralisation of our legislative system, centralisation of our overall political system. And this is where we get to the nitty-gritty. This might represent the majority, but that's not justice. I mean, you could turn around and you want to be really crass. You could say, hey, this girl wants it and six other guys want it. Well, that doesn't make it right. And that's my point. Democracy isn't necessarily the best system actually out there. Just because the majority want it doesn't make it just. What we'd really like to have is a free system, which is what happened in Iceland, and it happened in Ireland, and it happened in Scotland, where people get in and they discuss, and it's not until you get a full 100% consensus that actually laws were implemented. Well, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. What we have now is a majority, and the majority is shaped by where the funding comes from, and that doesn't ring true to me. So this is what I think is going to actually basically happen. You know, we're going to end up with the Les Weebles, and at least this is where the Internet Māori Party, and to a degree, Winston Peters, as much as I hate to admit it, and this is my favourite person politician, are a valuable mix because they bring in people that actually have the interests of New Zealanders, not vested outside groups. Which, of course, then brings the Internet Māori Party we bring into the next part of the equation, which is, gosh darn it, this entire election has been based around mass surveillance. And John Keith tells us, if we listen to him, that there is no mass surveillance in New Zealand, that Glenn Greenwald, and I'll put that in brackets, sick, but Glenn Greenwald, Edward Snowden, Julian Assange are all quote-unquote henchmen of Kim.com. Well, you know, well, Jesus, John, is that, you know, you talk about conspiracy theory, that's pretty fucking, can't say that word, that's pretty far-fetched. At the end of the day, if you turn around and say that these three people who represent people that have got international accolades, including a Pulitzer Award, which you generally don't get for writing material for paid lobbyists, unlike Cameron Slater, you can't really say that they're henchmen. These are people that have respected professionals that have a good track record of doing what they're doing. But hey, John Key wants to tell us that this is, these guys are henchmen and there was no mass surveillance in New Zealand. This is semantics. This is pure semantics of the kind of yes prime minister. For any of those that are under the age of 30, yes minister, which is the series I refer to, was commonly based on the real politics, the Machiavellian politics of UK politics based on Margaret Thatcher. And that's what we have right now. We have this ludicrous system where they, by using careful semantics that are being coached to them by public relations experts and marketing experts, they can say things which are not, strictly speaking, lying, but they're not true. On this basis, let's break this down. John Key tells us that the GCSB are not conducting, it's not conducting mass surveillance. Well, anybody that's actually turned around and looked at the way that the signals intelligence related services have operated for the last 20 years will tell you that it's fairly well known that what happens is that, for example, the GCSB do not conduct mass surveillance in New Zealand because that would be illegal. What they do, however, is that they pass on information from people that the NSA want to be spied on, and they pass it on to the NSA. That way, the NSA, and I'm going to contradict myself shortly, but that way, the NSA follows the law book and they don't break the laws of America, which also prohibits mass surveillance. On the other hand, the NSA will also turn around and they will use GCSB facilities as they just find their own people, pass their information back to New Zealanders. So that way, it's a quid pro quo. Quote, New Zealand doesn't spy on New Zealanders, it spies on Americans. Americans don't spy on New Zealand, they spy on, Americans don't spy on Americans, Americans spy on New Zealanders. Not the way to give it for a loophole. Except, it's actually quite interesting, because when you look at the whole religious process of all declassified documents, even in this case, they're saying, oh no, we specifically are not doing that. Which then brings us to the next level of the game. New Zealand might say, we are not taking information from America about New Zealand, because that would be breaking law or moral or whatever. However, there's a little thing in 2007, which was called the Terrorism Suppression Bill, which then turned around and meant that the definition of terrorism was subversive in New Zealand was no longer defined by the Ninth Law or the Prime Minister's Office. It was an actual fact, now, or in fact, is now decided by bureaucrats, and not even necessarily a high-level one, but by bureaucrats in America. So what actually now happens is that you can be on your little internet thing going blah, 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 blah. Someone in the NSA can go, actually, this is not conducive to what we think is right. We will brand this person a subversive or a terrorist. They can then send that back to New Zealand, this person is a terrorist and subversive. Because that person is a terrorist and subversive, the GCSB now can find that person. So it's all about semantics and all smoke and mirrors, ways that they can get around the system. However, we then get to another point. John Key says about the Southern Cable, I am not aware that the NSA are using this to spy on New Zealanders, because that would be illegal. Point one, in Europe, and specifically in Germany, and this has become, you know, major, the Spiegel, the BBC, Washington Post, they've all covered this. Guess what? They've done mass surveillance of people in Germany and other countries in Europe, which have had head states complain about it. And you know what? It has been branded illegal. And this is a very big point in American politics and American media right now. What the NSA are doing is illegal. However, the NSA is protected by a charter circa 1946, 1947. It's about a one-paragraph charter. This charter basically means that the NSA could be doing something illegal defined by American law and American legislation. However, the way that the NSA is protected, there is no accountability. There is no means of investigating it. So in other words, like common monsters, it's a case of, yeah, but what are you going to do about it? So John Key might say, oh no, that would be illegal. And it is illegal. But there is no accountability. And this is what's going on right now. The other aspect which boils down to when we deal with this whole subject is the question of the cable. In fact, the cable, will come back to the cable and we'll give credit accordingly due to it in the next segment of the show. But that cable is a very important part, and we talk about the Southern Cable, that show the fact that mass surveillance is occurring in New Zealand, and it is occurring on that cable, and what's more, when John Key says that he's not aware of the NSA having an office in New Zealand, the guy is either woefully ignorant or lying, and either of these do not make for a good Prime Minister. You are listening to The Postman Show via Vinnie Eastwood, care of Dunedin, broadcasting out to New Zealand. We'll be back with you very shortly in the next segment on the show. And you're on The Postman Show with Ben Vigin reporting down here in Dunedin, the bottom of New Zealand, the top of the world, depending on your perspective. And perspective is a very important aspect because, of course, but what is truth exactly? That all depends on how you choose to look at it. I can't tell you what the truth is. I'm not here to tell you what the truth is. I'm here to tell you my perspective of the truth, and I will try and back it up with the best research that I can, provide you the material that you can go and source away independently. And I will say anything since this is my pilot show on the show, but I ask one thing for people out there to listen to. If you want to know the truth, and you want to know whether I'm speaking the truth, go away and do your own research, because at the end of the day, I'm not here to tell you your truth. I'm here to simply give you good information which you can go away and cross-reference. My background, one of the other things I used to do was I used to work in the territories of intelligence, and the way intelligence works is you don't go up to your boss and tell him the truth. You give him the best information, and if he's a good officer, he has three or four other different intelligence guys, he takes all information, and from that, he gets the best information. That's what I'm asking you to do. I'll give you good information. Don't take my truth to be the sole truth. Always cross-reference everything I say. And on that note, let's get back to the juicy, juicy subjects of the cable. Now, I'm going to start the story in a roundabout way and bear me with a wee bit because, oddly enough, when we're talking about technology, technology doesn't want to do what I'm doing tonight. But we will get there. We'll start off with the Southern Cable story. And let's give credit due where credit's due. Ev Traveller, who was also one of the broadcasters on the Venice new format, rang me up a couple of days ago, and she's talking about, she said, oh, you know, I want a bit of help because I'm interested in the Southern Cable thing, and Claire Curran said a few remarks, and I was busy, and I went, oh, yeah, that's nice, Ev, we'll talk later. And 15 seconds later, Alan Johnson turned around, who's one of my contacts from Facebook, and he said, have you seen this thing about the cable outage? And I looked at him, and I went, hmm. And for those who don't know, this is how it works. Yeah, the Southern Cable, which Edward Snowden is maintaining has been tapped into by the NSA. The CEO of that particular company has turned around and said, this is absolutely nonsense because if this occurred, there'd be an outage and there'd be an automatic fail-safe system and blah, 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 blah. Well, oddly enough, there actually was an outage. And it kind of went like this. In November 2012, the symptoms that the CEO of Southern Cable described occurred. They did exactly that. And it's interesting because if you actually go back and look at John Key, he's actually saying, well, actually, yes, this cable was utilized for this purpose, but we decided later on that we wouldn't use the method. So in other words, they tested it, but they chose not to implement it. As the TUI ad goes, yeah, right. The same cable, interestingly enough, you know, we're all worried about the NSA. There was an alternative cable put through in which there was a tender process put up for. Interesting thing about it was the company, Chinese company called Huawei, well, the company owned by Huawei, H-U-A-W-E-I, they got the contract to win it. This upset all our Five Eyes, and this is the Signals Intelligence Alliance that New Zealand belongs to, got upset because they were saying, well, no, the Chinese can be using this for phones. Well, gosh darn it, they would know, wouldn't they? So in other words, they're telling us right now this cable can't be used for surveillance, yet they were making public statements in their own Congress records. And this is in the United States, the United Kingdom, and Australia, and the three allies of the Five Eyes saying this can be done. So which is it? Were they lying then or were they lying now? But, okay, they turn around and they let Huawei turn around and do this. And what actually interesting also happened here was that Huawei, a Chinese company owned by State by China, run by just like the company that's actually running the cable from the American end, is all stacked with people that have information technology, communication, military intelligence backgrounds. And we're talking about the NSA, the Pentagon, and so on. This is just like you are, just like in I think it's Cinena, C-I-N-E-N-A. Two companies, see the side that when you look at them and you look at technical people, it reads like Spooksville. And this is what Huawei's doing. This is who they're run by. Now, in Huawei's case, the worry was that what happens is that when they turn around, how they do is they bring in a politician and they give them a good time, and through that, they get the tender process. And then once they've got the tender process through, depending on euphemism, giving them a gift or a black bribe, once they're in the door, they constantly use that to re-entrench a particular situation. Now, this situation, it's not just vested interests of UK, Australia, United States intelligence services going, oh, no, they're the bad guys, we won't do it. But in India and the Philippines, that company's not allowed to operate anymore because that's exactly what they did. They got caught bribing local politicians to get public contracts to get access to a cable, which they knew and then used for surveillance. In New Zealand, Huawei came up with a story, National Business Review actually ran it, they're one of the few mainstream parties that actually pushed that issue, but no one ever asked Stephen Joyce a key critical question, which is, okay, Stephen, former CEO of MediaWorks, that's the same guys that got a $40 million subsidy, the same guys that have been given the official coverage for the elections, which means that they can hold a camera on one politician, and if that politician is sounding good, i.e. John Key, they hold it as long as they want. If he's sounding good and it's not the one they want, then they just cut it to back to where they want or an ad break. course, if he sounded like a dickhead, then they'd be a close-up. So, but that's besides the point. We'll get back to the point. Stephen Joyce, Minister of Communication, has never been answered or asked the question of, okay, if you wipe put in a tender process, what was their bid and what does it compared to the other parties? Now, we will have heard about Judith Collins on NVIDIA, and we know about the Kari situation, which is a similar situation where Chinese companies with connections into national politicians have managed to get the best interest. Nobody wants to ask those questions. And that's pretty much all the same situation that we have going back to the whole cable, Southern Cable. Nobody wants to ask difficult questions about how this cable came to be about, who signed it, who authorized it, who's responsible. And I guess it's a fairly important question because, you know, when we go back a few years ago, we talk about investigative journalists, including Nikki Hager, including myself, as Alistair Thompson from Scoop Media pointed out, being listed as subversive journalists. Well, you know what? That issue didn't actually occur under a National Party. It occurred under a Labour Party. And we have the same situation with both National and Labour that, yeah, it's very convenient right now to bag National for certain things, but there's no guarantee that Labour gets in that any of this is going to change. Because let's not forget, it was actually Longing that brought in Waihopo in the first place. And Longing was told that if he built this thing, it was going to give New Zealand national sovereignty independence. It hasn't done that at all. It's done the opposite. Same situation. You know, we go on about ANZUS, you know, we pulled out of ANZUS, we had nothing to do with Americans. Well, at that time, the SAS got 34% of the military budget, and that budget continued to increase the SAS. And we now know the SAS, up until even pre-9/11, had been going up and doing jobs for all sorts of, for the United States, for all sorts of other organizations that we don't get told about. So at the end of the day, both under National and Labor, we end up with a security system that does not necessarily represent what we as Kiwis wanted to do. So that's, you know, one of my issues, basically, about the whole situation is, like, A, the whole yes minister situation. No one asks the correct questions. No one holds these people and actually lets them, you know, say, wait a minute, okay, John Key, you say it's not mass surveillance. Well, wait a minute, what's your definition of mass surveillance? And when you talk about mass surveillance, well, hey, this legislation actually was specifically tweaked to allow metadata. And when you look at what metadata can do, that's a lot of information that people can occur. So, you know, it's all semantics. At the end of the day, it's there's a joke. I mean, the joke goes, back in the Cold War days, there's a guard standing duty on Checkpoint Charlie across the line between Germany and Russia, and he sees a little black dot on the horizon. And as he's standing near the horizon, the black dot gets bigger, 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 till it fills the entire horizon. And as he gets close to the visual image, he realizes that what he's actually seeing is a wall of rabbits running towards him. Just, and, you know, and they're running past him left, right, and center. He doesn't know what to do. Eventually, he takes one rabbit, he sticks his gun in his face. Halt! The rabbit comes to grind your halt. What are you doing? So Stalin has just passed an edict that if you're a giraffe, it's a crime against the state. And the guard turns to the rabbit and goes, but you're a rabbit. The rabbit turns around and goes, tell that to Stalin. And this is what we have. We have definitions defined by legislation and our politicians. And they sound, you know, you can argue because that's what the word says, oh, if you do this. But we all know at the end of the day, metadata, mass surveillance, whatever, we are being spied upon. This is what the heads of state in Europe are telling the people. This is what every single signal intelligence expert the last 20 years has been saying upon people. So you got a choice. You can either believe these people, heads of state from large countries in Europe, you can believe experts that have accolades after accolades, or you can believe a guy like John Key, who at the end of the day is represented by some fairly vested interests, and he'll tell you, you have nothing to fear if you have nothing to hide. Well, that he's saying that alone worries me, because that's actually the statement that Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Public Enlightenment and Propaganda, the irony there alone, was telling people in Nazi Germany, if you have nothing to fear, you'll have nothing to hide. Hey, at the end of the day, we have privacy. We have a right to privacy. And that doesn't mean that the government can turn around and just come and spy on whatever because of our freedoms. You know, there was a piece today on the newspaper by Fran Sullivan saying that, hey, wait a minute, before we put Edward Snowden on a pedestal, let's consider that his information, what it's doing to Al-Qaeda, it's allowing them to subvert the security systems and thus carry out bombing attacks. He's getting people killed. And I made the point in the posting that I put up this morning that that statement is absolute bollocks. I make it for three basic principal reasons why I said this concept that Edward Snowden's leaking of a sense of intelligence is getting people killed. And I made these three points, and they are as follows. Number one, even before 9/11, professional terrorists were opting for a low-tech approach to avoid deception. In fact, they used surveillance to run deception. So, for example, the chatter in the lead-up to 9/11 had authorities looking at Asia, not at home, having been cyber manipulated by the terrorists. So in other words, you have mass surveillance. If you've got guys that are actually bad guys, they know that you've got mass surveillance, and they can actually use that against you. It's the basic principle of Aikido, martial arts. If you're weak, you use the force of your opponent against them. And this is basically what insurgents are doing this day and age with signal intelligence. Signal intelligence is actually a fairly flawed system. Number two, intelligence was largely hampered by one key factor in the 1980s. The CIA lost the vast majority of its professional Middle Eastern experts following the bomb which detonated at the US Embassy in Beirut. Not only was this loss of valuable intelligence assets with valuable contacts and intuitive skills, including in-depth understanding of complexities of the language like Farsi that could not be lost, but one which signal intelligence failed to spot. In other words, they lost the human element and they were relying upon raw data, and raw data on a computer chip cannot actually pick up the finalities or the subtle points. I'll carry on. In contrast, human intelligence unit, the elite covert military intelligence service, elite covert military intelligence units known as ISA, had already blocked the likelihood of an imminent attack on the embassy and had the intelligence blocked from on high. This would be an all too familiar pattern where human gathered intelligence was time and time again not acted upon. There is no reason to suspect that this political interference would lessen with cyber intelligence than human intelligence. In the end, all material must be bottlenecked on high, and if not acted upon due to cognitive dissonance, politics, or God knows whatever, of the political masters, the failure is not Snowden's, but an unwillingness to see the facts as they are, as opposed to how we wish them to be. In other words, there have been plenty of opportunities to detect terrorism attacks in the event, but because of or where that brings us, it makes our masters uncomfortable, they choose to push that intelligence away. And I'll give a classic example. John O'Connor, who went on to head the head of security for the World Trade Center on 9/11 on September 1st, it was his first day of the job, former head of the New York Terrorist Counter Unit, the FBI's counter-terrorist unit in New York, quit the job, and his quote was, I'm not allowed to investigate terrorism because of the politics of oil. This actually reinforced another comment that Benazir Bhutto, later on assassinated, made when she turned around in 1995, 6 years before World Trade Center, and said, the person that bombed the World Trade Center, who tried to assassinate me, this has nothing to do with Islam and everything to do with the politics of oil. This is again what the ISA found. They were not allowed to investigate units because it was tied to people that were too close to that the USA's lobbyist groups were tied with. So signal intelligence will never pick this up. So Snowden, this is the very point that Snowden reported on. He's talking about these vested interest groups. He's saying mass intelligence doesn't stop terrorist attacks because it doesn't go to the root of where those attacks come from. And of course, Sullivan, who's a very respected and veteran journalist, she's covered lots of stories, and you know, and I have a lot of respect for her, but she does seem to get a little bit conservative these days, should know better. Spooks have for years been claiming body counts when measures exposing the infringement of civil liberties have occurred. Snowden, in contrast, also showed the agency was, and here's the key point, being lied to the public as a result of US soldiers unnecessarily put in harm's way. The U.S. Supreme Court was very, very clear on this in 1971 during the case of the Pentagon Papers, which was the release of historic papers concerning the cause and the way in which the Vietnam War occurred. It made clear that the press has a duty to print even classified material when they find this to be the case. And we know from what Edward Snowden, Julian Assange has published that this is not just a case of revealing the inner workings of the CIA. It showed that these agencies, via their lies, have actually caused U.S. soldiers and those who are sworn to serve and protect harm. So when you do a body count, how much people have the whole signal intelligence the US actually calls that are meant to be working for them versus what is being alleged, it doesn't outweigh. It's quite clear Snowden, if you want to count on pure crass terms of body count, is saving more lives than risking more lives. And I make that point too. I know Nikki Hager quite well. I know the way I work, and I know various other journalists too who have been put in the spotlight. We're very specific. We never run a story which puts those in the security services in harm's way in a tactical measure. We will only talk about events in the hindsight, in the forethought. In other words, we'll talk about before it occurs or after it occurs. But we know a good journalist, and this is why I believe Grenwell, who's reporting on the case of Snowden, and those who report on Julian Assange done, we've never put anyone in harm's way. We've been quite fair in more ways than you could say Wilder has ever been. And this is the man, of course, that chose chop, chop. You know, this is the thing. John Key wants to associate himself with a guy like Whale Oil, who actually, say, deliberately leaked information on Nikki Hager to have him killed. Chop, chop, goodbye, Nikki. But he will turn around and call a Pulitzer-winning journalist a henchman. I think there's a fairly obvious discrepancy going on there. My fourth point, this is a little bit more of a complex point. Sadly, our press continues to ignore many, many, many cases showing that Western intelligence services and those with military ties are conducting campaigns of manipulation using agent provocateurs. It is doubtful such forces will ever be detected by mass surveillance or brought to justice, so while the police state ramps up a willing terrorist, and I'll put that in context if anyone's ever in 1984, it's a situation of, yeah, they are terrorists because the state makes them. And that's it. Anyone in the police state ramps up all in terrorists will continue to strike different sides of the same coin. When you look at the whole situation of Al-Qaeda, we have Benazir Bhutto. We have John O'Connor, as I previously mentioned, head of the FBI's anti-terrorist unit. We have Robin Cook, head of the Homeland Security. We have Seymour Hersh, a Jewish journalist. Four prominent people and all experts in the field saying there is no such thing as Al-Qaeda. What you have is you have mercenaries that have been hired to conduct attacks. And when you look at a picture, as recently on ISS, of a Islamic terrorist with his mask over his face, and you look at his arm and it has US Army tattooed on the side, you have to call a question, really, do we have terrorists or do we have just mercenaries? And then those mercenaries are working for the very same groups that control and fund the NSA, is it likely that mass surveillance will ever detect those terrorists, or simply will the risk of terrorism continue to be an excuse to increase the power of the state? This is what happened under Nazi Germany. This is what my grandfather, Robinson Cox, fought for, lest we forget. There is a very good reason why we have checks and balance in our government to prevent this. And so I say, oh no, that doesn't happen. Well, that's assumption. And that was assumption which we learned at great cost, which why we have Anzac Day every year to celebrate those who fought that great cost that we cannot afford to repeat. I made that point. At the end of the day, people like Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, Nikki Hager, Private Bradley Manning, essential part of democracy. They are what keeps things in check. And having the NSA, a GCC, an MI6, an ASIO turn around saying, oh no, you must give us more money because there's increased terrorist attacks, because we tell you, and you have to take our word, is not good enough. It's not what my grandfather fought for. It's not what many of your grandfathers fought for. And, you know, I don't write this from a viewpoint of being a left-wing radical. The reality is I don't ever consider myself to be left or right-wing. I actually think it's the same turkey. I spent 6 years in the territorial. D77971 is my service member. I wasn't NSA's commander. I was actually fairly mediocre, a private Benjamin of the truth be known. But I did it because of what my grandfather did it. And I've carried that pack on my back. And I take what the people in our services do very, very seriously, and I have great respect for them. But just because their bosses and their political masters tell us this is how it should be, it's not good enough. And you can use all the semantics, all the legalization, it doesn't change a fundamental fact. And this is from someone that's dyslexic, and my own little publication down here is, you know, the little joke around here locally is, you know, Postman Gazette, free typos to good homes. Yeah, at the end of the day, the truth is, a fool, a joker, can lisp great wisdom, while a prince can lie in the most elegant of languages. Just because someone doesn't put a comma behind something or doesn't have a degree behind his name doesn't mean they're not speaking the truth. And at the end of the day, what you really must look at is motive. All crime is based on motive, method, and operandi. Do we look at the people out there who have continuously gone out and done things, not because they want to profit, not because they want fame, but because they believe in a fair egalitarian, a good listen and a good fair deal for everybody? Or do we listen to people that continuously have made clear that profit is what they're all about and who have been caught lying time and time and time again? I think the answer is fairly obvious. You've been listening to The Postman Show, Ben Vidgen from down south here in Dunedin, courtesy of Vinnie Eastwood, and I will be talking to you next week on a subject which is a little bit more all over the place. I'll pick one subject and we'll stick to it. But I hope you've listened, liked what you listened, and I'll be bringing you more of that time and time again. This is Ben Vidgen, The Postman Show. Good night and good luck.